On November 8th of last year, Pastor Rick, pastor of a small alliance church in Palo in the Philippines, was huddled in a small room along with his family and eight other families in a room that was no more than about a tenth of the space we have here. This room was on the first floor of his home. It was their church. And outside this rickety building, Super Typhoon Haiyan unleashed its unparalleled ferocity on the town. To make matters worse, a tidal surge was flooding the town, and thick black water was rising rapidly and was soon pretty dangerously almost inches away from where they were standing on the first floor. All this time, those gathered in the room, whether Christian or not, were praying and praising the Lord, led by Pastor Rick. On November 10th, the winds had begun to die down, and is it wet? Bottom. Let's try that. Okay, that works. The winds had died down, and the water levels had begun to subside. The water now had a stench of rotting garbage, sewage, and decomposing bodies, and finally subsided to about a two-foot-thick black sludge. While thanking God for the survival of all those in that space, Pastor Rick went over to the window to try and get his bearings, a window that had somehow miraculously survived the storm. And as he looked out, all he could see was this. Everything had been flattened. He didn't know where the street ended or began. The trees had no leaves. As he looked out, he thought, where do I begin? Lord, how do I be light in this place which has suddenly become very, very dark? And what would you have me do in this community? It seems as though God was a million miles away. Those were the thoughts and questions that were running through my head as I woke up on a Friday morning in May of 2012. 2 days earlier, I had been let go from the company that I was working in. And I had conflicting emotions running through me. On one hand, there was relief. Relief in that for the past couple of months, the attitudes and business practices that the business was undertaking, I had trouble reconciling with my faith and my beliefs. And so in a way, this was, I guess, an answer to prayer. On the other hand, I was very uneasy. My job prospects looked grim at best, and I knew I was in for a rough ride. So what do I do? I don't know if you know what it is like to work in workplaces that are very dark, where co-workers have no qualms about sharing their disdain and dislike for Christ followers, of places that really stir your heart for his name's sake, but don't seem to shift an inch. What do you do? What would you have me do, Lord, in this situation, in this new normal? And what do you do when answers don't seem to be very forthcoming? I think Ruby Hamilton would identify with some of those feelings. See, Ruby is a businesswoman in her 50s, and she was stunned at the loss of her husband of 32 years in a car crash. Ruby's grief and disappointment, though, ran deeper than just a typical expression of grief. See, she had become a Christ follower at the age of, in her early 20s, and her husband did not share her newfound interest in spiritual things. But Ruby nevertheless committed to praying for him every day. And she prayed unceasingly and fervently that he would come to know the Lord in a real and personal way. As she kept praying, one day she felt a wave of peace wash over her. And a still small voice assured her that her husband would be okay. She eagerly awaited for the day when he would come to know the Lord and surrender his life to Jesus. But now, this? What do you do when faith doesn't seem to make sense? When God doesn't seem to be answering, being found, or opening doors? For Ruby Hamilton, She stopped living for God. Roger Simmons was hitchhiking his way home. He'd never forget the day. It was May the 7th, and the day he had been discharged from the army. He couldn't wait to get home and put down his duffel bag, which was weighing a ton, and hang up his army uniform once and for all. Hearing an oncoming car coming, he flashed his thumb, but soon lost hope as he saw it was a black, brand new, sleek Cadillac. But the car pulled up ahead, and the passenger door swung wide open. So running up to the car, he chucked his duffel bag in the back and slid into the leather passenger seat next to the driver. As the driver said, "Going home for keeps?" "Sure am," said Roger. "Well, you're in luck if you're heading to Chicago." "Well, not quite that far. Do you live in Chicago?" "Ah, I run a business there. My name's Hamilton." And so Roger and Hamilton continued to banter on various topics, but Roger, who was a Christ follower himself, couldn't ignore the feeling that he should share the gospel with this 50-ish, rather successful-looking, handsome businessman. And he tried putting it off, but with 30 minutes or less to where he needed to jump off, Roger figured it was now or never. So he said, "Mr. Hamilton, there's something very important that I need to share with you." And so he explained God's plan for salvation, and then ultimately asked him if he'd like to receive Jesus as his Lord and Savior. The car suddenly veered to the side of the road and came to a complete stop. Roger expected to be thrown out of the car. The driver then leant against the steering wheel and received Christ that day. As he let Roger out later on at his destination, he thanked him and said, "Thank you, Roger. That's probably the greatest thing that has ever happened to me in my life." 5 years went by, and Roger was now a businessman in his own right, married, had 2 kids, and had to go into Chicago for business. And as he was packing a small suitcase, he came across a business card that Hamilton had given him some 5 years ago. And so he determined that he would look up Mr. Hamilton. In Chicago, he walked into Hamilton Enterprises and was rather bewildered and confused when the secretary was very insistent that he couldn't speak to Mr. Hamilton, but could speak to Mrs. Hamilton, and found himself being ushered into a beautiful office and stood facing a keen-eyed woman in her 50s. As she extended her hand, she asked of him, "You knew my husband?" "Yes," said Hamilton. I met him 5 years ago as I was hitchhiking home." "What day was that?" "May the 7th of the day I got discharged from the army." "Was there anything special about that day or your trip with my husband?" Well, Roger wasn't sure if he should share that he had shared the gospel with Mr. Hamilton, but said, "Ruby, Mrs. Hamilton, he pulled over that day as I had explained the gospel to him, and he received Christ as he sobbed against the steering wheel. He gave his life to Christ that day." Explosive sobs shook her body as Mrs. Hamilton finally got a grip on herself and said, "For years I prayed for my husband's salvation, and for years I believed that God would save him. But Ruby, where is your husband? He's dead. He died 5 years ago, not long after he let you out. He died in a car crash. You see, for years I prayed for my husband's salvation, and then he died. And I stopped living for God because I thought he didn't keep his word." Now, I'd like to pause here for a moment, because there may be someone here who doesn't quite understand what God's plan for salvation is, or what grace really means. And perhaps for some of us, it's become a little stale or old hat. So, guys, let's see if we can illustrate this for you. Okay. But sometimes I find things make more sense when I put it into a bit of a contemporary context. So take a listen to this. Okay. So if grace is what fuels us as Christ followers, as I was grappling with the questions that were running through my head and the issues that I was dealing with, I really felt that there had to be more to what I was trying to achieve as a Christ follower and the way I live my life. And as I turned, as I normally do, to the Bible for answers, I couldn't help but think of a legendary yet historical Scottish figure. Most of you, I believe, have seen the movie Braveheart and will remember Mel Gibson playing the role of William Wallace, who attempted to fight for freedom from British rule. You may also remember this person, Robert the Bruce, or he played the role of Robert the Bruce. What you may not know is he looks a bit more like that. But Robert the Bruce, after William's execution, having betrayed William and being executed, he actually rose up to lead Scotland to freedom. In 1329, at the age of 54, he died. But before he died, he asked that his heart be removed and be taken on a crusade by a worthy knight. Now, James Douglas, a close friend of his who was at his bedside at the time, took on the responsibility. So when Robert the Bruce died, his heart was removed, embalmed, placed in a small container, which Douglas then wore around his neck. So literally in every battle that Douglas fought, he had the heart of his king pressed up against his chest. In the spring of 1330, Douglas sailed from Scotland to Granada in Spain in a campaign against the Moors. And in an ill-fated battle, Douglas found himself surrounded by the enemy on all sides. In that moment, death was certain and imminent. In that moment, he reached out for the heart of his king, tore it off his neck, threw it into the midst of the enemy, and shouted, "Fight for the heart of your king." Historians quote him as saying, "Forward, brave heart, as ever thou were wont to do, and Douglas will follow his king's heart or die." The motto of the Douglas clan, to which the present-day Duke belongs, is even to this day simply forward. Although anyone who understands the heart of God knows that the Crusades were a tragic lesson in missing the point, this incident awakens within me something of a primal longing that I'm convinced resides and waits to be unleashed in those of us who are followers of Christ. See, to belong to God is to belong to his heart. And if we have responded to his call to leave everything and follow him, then there is a voice within each of us crying out, "Fight for the heart of your king." Now, if I'm right about this primal, barbarian type call, then perhaps the men and women closest to God will most powerfully live out this raw, untamed spirit. And questions we could ask are, when Jesus walked among us, who did he choose to represent him? Or what kind of person did God choose to prepare the way for the coming of his son? His name was John. You might know him as John the Baptist. And if you're reading Matthew 3, verses 1 to 12, there are a few things that stand out right away. For example, he was an unusual dresser and had strange eating habits. I'm not a fashionista, but I have it on good authority that even in Jesus' day, wearing clothes made out of camel hair was not the height of fashion. And we're told that he ate locusts and wild honey. I can only assume that the honey was to help get the locusts down. He was clearly not a fan of the established religious leaders at the time. The Pharisees and Sadducees, who were the religious elite of the time, he had a nickname for them. He called them brood of vipers, not a term of endearment. You might also note that his fire and brimstone messages were directed entirely at the religious and not the irreligious. He was, in many ways, a barbarian in the midst of a civilization. He had no patience for the domesticated religionists who were drowning in their own self-righteousness. Think about this. The guy had no formal education, no degrees. His occupation was prophet, and his mailing address was the wilderness. There is something, however, that troubles me about John the Baptist. And I find it in this verse in Matthew 11, verse 3. John sent his disciples to ask Jesus a question. Are you the one who was to come, or should we expect someone else? For someone like John, this seemed quite out of place. How could John be uncertain whether Jesus was the one? Now, you remember that John and Jesus were cousins. And if you read the account in Luke 1, verses 39 to 45, you will probably remember that Mary and Elizabeth, they're pregnant and they meet up. So John's in his mother's womb, Jesus is in his mother's womb, and the ladies meet up. And if you see it, John actually leaps. See, in his fetal position, he recognized who Jesus was. I can only imagine a little voice emanating from Elizabeth's womb saying, "Are you the one, or should we expect another?" In the womb, John knew. But then 30 years later, he didn't. There are several instances in John's life, if you read on, that we see that he was very clear on his mission to prepare the way for the coming Messiah and as to who Jesus was. So what in the world was John thinking? How could he send his disciples with a question like that? And you don't have to go too far to find the reason for John's confusion. Just before Matthew records John's question, he tells us what prompted John's crisis of faith. See, John was in prison. Herod had arrested John and put him in prison on account of Herodias. Now, Herodias was Herod's brother's, Philip, his name was Philip, wife. And Herod and Herodias were having an affair, and John, in his typically barbaric fashion, called it for what it was, refusing to placate to Herod's power or to cower to him. Herod wanted to kill John, but was afraid of the reaction of the people, so the people considered him a prophet and loved him for it. Anyway, one day it's Herod's birthday. He throws a bit of a party. Herodias' daughter dances for him, and Herod is pleased, and I say that in an evil sort of way. And makes an oath to give her whatever she wants. In a plot between Herodias and her daughter, they ask for John's head on a platter. Herod is distressed for political reasons, but grants them what they want. And that is the background for John's dilemma. See, he was literally living between prison and the platter when he sent this message to Jesus. Shouldn't he expect Jesus to drop everything and rush to his aid? After all, he was there when Jesus needed him. Or was he just unaware of John's plight, or simply indifferent? Or was he really the Messiah, as John had always believed? When Jesus receives the inquiry from John's disciples, he gives quite an impressive response. He says, "Go back and report to John what you hear and see. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, those who have leprosy are cured, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the good news is preached to the poor. Blessed is the man who does not fall away on account of me." And that's Matthew 11, verses 4 to 6. Now, at first glance, you would think that Jesus was trying to inspire John with something like, "Don't sweat it, bud. I'm doing everything that you would expect of a Messiah," and you have to admit it's a pretty impressive resume. The lame walking, people with leprosy being cured, the deaf hearing, even the blind seeing, and to top it off, the good news being preached to the poor. I mean, how could you argue with that? You would expect John to be overwhelmed with joy, come back to his senses, and wonder how he could possibly ask Jesus such a question. There's one small problem, though. See, John already knew that. In fact, in Matthew, we're told there was part of the problem, and I'm referring to Matthew 11, verses 2 and 3. When we look to Jesus' response to John, we see one line that somehow doesn't fit in. After he reinforced all of the evidence that he was the Messiah, retelling his miraculous work amongst the people, he closes with a line that's seemingly disconnected. He says, "Blessed is the man who doesn't fall away on account of me." Now, why would he add that? Why would he even consider the thought that someone might fall away with so much good happening? I can't imagine anyone coming up to me and saying, "Too many blind people are regaining their sight. I'm having a crisis of faith." Or someone confronting me saying, "If one more paralyzed person rises up and walks, I'm out of here." Miracles are rarely followed by mass recanting. So why would Jesus feel the need to exhort John and say that? I think what Jesus was saying to John is far too barbaric to keep in the mainstream of Christian faith. Jesus was essentially saying to John, "John, I'm not coming through for you. I'm not getting you out of prison. I'm not sparing your life. Yes, I have done all this and more for others, but the path I choose for you is different from theirs. And you'll be blessed, John, if this does not cause you to fall away." If that were not bad enough, we find the dissonance of this reality actually accentuated in one verse, and that's in the opening chapter of Mark. Mark says, after John was put in prison, Jesus went into Galilee proclaiming the good news. Well, what was the good news for John? Jesus knew all along that John had been imprisoned. He very well knew the fate that John would face. Even then, Jesus understood his purpose was not to save us from pain and suffering, but rather from meaninglessness. For Jesus, John was exactly where he needed to be, fulfilling God's purpose for his life. Why would he save John from that? In the same passage, Jesus explained, the time has come. The kingdom of God is near. Repent and believe the good news. So what is the good news? Now, I don't know what it was like to you, for you as you grew up or as you came to the Lord, but growing up in something of a Christian environment, I have heard a few versions. The refined and civilized version goes something like this. Jesus died and rose from the dead so that you can live a life of endless comfort, security, and indulgence. But really, that's a bit too developed. Usually, it's a bit more like this. If you simply confess that you're a sinner and believe in Jesus, then you'll be saved from the torment of eternal hellfire, and when you die, you'll go to heaven. Either case results in our domestication. One holds out for life to begin in eternity, and the other makes an absolute mockery out of life. The call of Jesus is far more primal, far more barbaric than either of these. It's a call to live in the world as citizens of an entirely different kingdom. In its primitive state, the good news cannot be separated from the invitation of Jesus to come, follow me. He never lied about the cost associated with or the danger in becoming his follower. He told them up front, I'm sending you out like sheep among wolves. Therefore, be as shrewd as snakes and as innocent as doves. And I'm quoting Matthew 10, verse 16. It's been hard the past 2 years for myself and my family. It's easy to kind of go into a mode where you batten down the hatches and cancel all the other extraneous things that we do, which includes being involved in missions and the global discipleship program that we were involved in. It's been really hard to trust, pray, and obey. I found that I'm not very good at it. But I think Evelyn Bredin, or now Evelyn Mangum, is a bit more of an authority on the subject. See, Evelyn Mangum and her daughter Patty Whalen had just come out of the American Alliance General Council that was held in Tampa, Florida last year when she heard the music. Now, Evelyn says she's learned many languages over the years, but Arabic is embedded in her gut. She said it's Arabic. And she did a ululation, a high-pitched trill that's commonly used at weddings in the Middle East. And they came running. It was a newly formed CNMA, Arabic-speaking Association's leadership team. Who are you, they asked. I'm Evelyn Bredin, she said. Bredin? Your father led my grandfather to the Lord. Your mother and father led my grandparents and my entire family to the Lord. Your mother led my grandmother to the Lord, and I've become a Christian since. They were laughing, they were singing, they were talking, they were crying all at the same time. I had never met any one of those people before, but she said, these were my people. If it hadn't been for the decision of the border managers back in 1922 regarding the sending of missionaries at the time and their decision to bend the rules, where would I be today? Where would these people be today? Evelyn says she grew up in a miracle home, a home where miracles happen just about every day. When Mum and Dad, George and Lola Bredin, met, fell in love, and got married, Dad was destined to become president of a company that Granddad ran, and a company that made manhole covers for the entire state of Ohio and Indiana. Dad was therefore, being the oldest, destined to become president, become a millionaire, and lead a Christian life. One day, Dad decided to attend a church service held behind a shoe store. It was a small cell group run by Alliance folk. And at the meeting, someone said, Arabia is closed to the gospel. That was all Dad needed. He said, I'll open it. When he told Granddad of his decision, Granddad said, "You're insane, you're crazy, I'll disown you." Dad told Mum. Mum said, "I thought you'll never ask." She was a dainty little sweetheart, a school teacher who played the piano for the silent movies at the time. They made plans and decisions and finally decided to move to the Missionary Training Institute in Nyack, New York. They were doing well until one day, Mum turned to Dad and said, "George, we're going to have another baby." Now, in the days, the border managers in the CNMA had a rule that stated that families with more than two children could not go into the mission field. Daddy was devastated. So he picked up pen and paper and wrote to the border managers saying, "God has called me to Arabia. Please make an exception. Please have mercy." The reply took a long time in coming. But when it did, Daddy couldn't open the envelope. He went to the chapel and called on a dear friend and prayer warrior, Orville Brooks. Dad said, "I'm not willing to stay in America. Arabia waits for me." So they prayed, and they prayed. And finally, Mr. Brooks turned to Dad and said, "Can we go now?" Dad said, "Not until I'm willing to stay in America. I cannot open this letter." And so they prayed. 1 hour turned into two, 2 hours turned into three, and on it went. Now, Orville Brooks was a slightly built man and very bony, and his knees began to really, really hurt. So he turned to Dad and said, "George, can we open the letter yet?" "No, not until I'm willing to stay in America. I cannot open this letter." And so they prayed. And after a long, prayerful and tearful time, Dad finally slit open the envelope, took out the letter, and read it. It said, "We've decided to make an exception. You may go to Arabia." Dad was thrilled. He decided to make plans for us when school was out. We would go back to Greenville, Ohio, sell the house, sell the cabin at Bulula Beach, sell all our belongings and the car, and then head to Arabia. So after quite a while, we packed everything up, and this day Dad was putting all the stuff into the car. Mum was looking after the baby, me, and Maria was looking after Marjorie. And to keep Marjorie entertained, she got a long stick and began whacking an oil painting that was hanging on the wall of the rented house that we were living in. Pretty soon, the beautiful painting was full of holes. Now, Daddy had set aside $50 to buy tickets for all of us to get to Greenville, Ohio, and he would have no more money until the house had sold. Daddy took one look at the painting, went over to the landlord, and said, "Sir, we've destroyed your painting. I'd like to pay you right now. How much is it?" $50, said the landlord. Daddy opened up his wallet, pulled out the bills as though he had 1,000 of them, handed them to the landlord, turned to Mother and said, hurry up, we need to get to this station." "George, are you crazy? We don't have a cent to buy tickets." "Hurry up, dear, we need to get to the station right now." At the station, they pulled out all their belongings out onto the lobby and lined up on the bench and waited for God to do something. Just then, a lady walked by. She stopped and said, "What a beautiful baby. Where are you going?" Dad said, "We're heading to Greenville, Ohio, and then on to Arabia." "Why, could I buy your tickets for you?" All my life, this has been the truth. God has shown his immense love for his servants. In Arabia, Daddy wasn't happy staying in Bethlehem or Jerusalem or Beersheba. That was big time. Daddy wanted to be at the end of the line, and that's where we always were. So we stayed in Man, in what was then the Transjordan under the British Mandate. Early one Sunday morning, when I was about 7 years old, she said, Dad and Mum realized I was really ill with paratyphoid fever. We were up in the Shimalin Mountains in Lebanon, and there were no medical facilities for miles around. So they decided to call on Louise Fritz, a fellow missionary and a registered nurse who happened to be in the area at the time. So Miss Fritz came over to look after me, and Dad and Mum left to go into the churches to ask for prayer and healing. To make things more efficient, they split up and literally interrupted church services in the area as they asked the congregation for prayer and healing. When Mom and Dad left, Mrs. Fritz realized that I had slipped away. And so she lay on top of me, just like Elijah did with a Shunammite boy. Forehead on my forehead, hands on my hands, feet on my feet, and then prayed that God would keep me alive till my parents returned. When my parents returned, they rushed me down the mountain into Beirut and into the American hospital. They were too late. My tongue was stiff, the pupils were dilated and fixed. The doctors and nurses cut my feet and arms, and there was no blood flow. The doctors and nurses wanted to take the body away into the mortuary, but Daddy said, "No. Leave her here in the room, and we'll pray over her all night. And if God doesn't raise her by the morning, then you may take the body." They were joined by this time by Orwell Brooks, now a fellow missionary. And so Mum, Dad, and Orwell Brooks prayed all night. Early Monday morning, I threw back the sheet covering my face and sat upright in bed. God had worked in a miraculous way. As we lived in Arabia, Marge and I did schooling in Jerusalem, in a British school. And during Christmas break, we would go back to join our parents. But on this one year, Mum called and said, "I don't think it would be very wise for you to come home this year. See, we have a demon-possessed woman staying with us. She's in the guest room." Now, it was quite common for people to bring their demon-possessed relatives to my parents. And my parents, along with other missionaries, would set aside whatever they were working on and pray them through. We have only a mattress in the guest room where she's staying. She's literally torn and destroyed everything else. Mother added, "We pray a couple of hours a day and are claiming God for deliverance, since he has already delivered so many others." When our parents said we couldn't come, Marge and I threatened to walk. So they relented and finally decided to hire a driver to drive us back home. Now, Daddy was a big man, but this demon-possessed woman had literally dragged him right across the floor. They found, however, that she was very afraid of sticks. So when we got out of the car, they gave one to each of us. And the woman never came near us as long as we had the sticks in our hands. It was quite a Christmas, as you can imagine. But eventually, she was marvelously delivered and then sat at Daddy's feet, soaking up the scripture so that she could become a Bible woman worthy of that title. And she became a wonderful, wonderful Christian. All my life it's been that way, and it's still going on. We had some really scary times, but it was just fantastic. See, I wouldn't give up one day of my life or change it, because God has done a miracle in my life, and I saw miracles, instant healings, almost every day. When I came back to life, the first thing I said was, "Mom, I want to have some ice cream." When I'm involved in the Global Discipleship Program, and we do a lot of training, and we take overseas trips. The question is it worth it? For a lot of people, they think, wouldn't it be better just to focus on local things? I mean, there are a lot of problems and issues over here as well. Let me offer you just a few snippets of what I've learned and picked up over the years as I've traveled. See, I've been to places where there have been quite a bit of poverty and devastation. And in such places, I've often felt that anything I do, even prayer, would literally be a drop in the ocean, almost insignificant. And at such times, I've had locals actually stream up to me, asking not for food or money or material things, but just for prayer. And I've been very, very humbled at such times. In 2004, as some of you might have watched, the tsunami affect various parts of Asia, I remember looking at the footage and saying, "Lord, what would you have me do? I mean, I have no skills. I have nothing to contribute. But what are we supposed to do as Christ followers? How are we supposed to respond?" And I remember praying along those lines, and little did I know at the time that Rick Bell, now Director of Missions of the CNMA here in Australia, was praying along similar lines, and that God would use the two of us earlier this year to take a team into Tacloban. A team that was impacted not in itself, but also impacted those around them. Local Filipinos, local church, people in Tacloban, and made it possible for others to actually go into such places. I don't know if you've ever stood behind a plastic surgeon and watched him give new life to an 18-month-old boy born with a cleft lip, who by virtue of his social status and poverty would have been an utter outcast. For 45 minutes I watched him sew, carve and stitch up with the skill of a medical artist. The before and after is a stunning picture of rebirth. I've heard the illustration of the wisdom of God's providence in sending missionaries from everywhere to everywhere, not just from the West to the developing world. An Ethiopian Christian missionary was sent into Muslim-dominated Pakistan. And when the mayor of the city in Pakistan heard of that, he told him that he may do whatever he wants. Why? Because 1,400 years ago, the fleeing Muhammad was given asylum in Ethiopia. He said, "We owe Ethiopia this favor." The question was asked, did he know that this man was a Christian missionary? And the answer was yes. And this is the sort of thing that God is doing all around the world. A missionary speaks of the remoteness of a life far from any city. The toilet is outside. And in the rainy season, not only do I have to contend with a downpour, but with snakes and hyenas. Not exactly your average Australian walk from bedroom to bathroom over dry carpet. A medical missionary corrected a common missionary counsel. He said that we're often told, if you're not an evangelist at home, then there's no chance you would be one when you go elsewhere. He said that in his case, it was not true. For him, the commitment to leave a lucrative medical practice, get on a plane, and serve in Africa has given him both the opportunities and the boldness to in witness that he had never had in his medical practice in the States. This is true, he says, both stateside, in the plane, and in Africa. So let's be careful about the kind of being too absolute in the kind of pronouncements we make. I don't know if you're familiar with the challenges of Muslim contextualization. A missionary who teaches a Muslim convert Bible stories, which he then travels 7 hours to repeat to a nomadic, unreached people group. But when she comes back to the hometown, she does not want to associate with the missionaries in public. She doesn't want to be known as a follower of Jesus and the missionary because it was too disruptive in her family. And the missionary was a bit perplexed. What do I do? It was suggested that she give her helper the benefit of the doubt and that perhaps she does not know what Jesus said about this. And it was suggested that she teach her some new stories that include texts like, "Whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel will save it. For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels." That's from Mark 35-38. "Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." Matthew 10:37. A missionary preparing to go into the field was, as part of her emergency medical training, was invited to cut herself so that she knew how to do the stitches properly. She did it, but not to worry. She practiced on cow tongue first. See, missions is not for wimpy women. I've heard the plea, and I give it here, that young people seriously seek a deep and unshakable God-given call to giving their lives to an unreached people group. Short-term missions does have value. But trying to accomplish long-term goals with short-term commitments is difficult. Most of the people left to reach are hard to reach. What is needed is the commitment of a life, not just a year, a language to learn, a culture to know, a people to love, a gospel to speak, a church to plant, leaders to train. This is the outpouring of a life. And may God give many of you this high, holy, and hard calling. Nevertheless, if any of you have life left, dream like you never have. A missionary who was a math major in university, spent most of his life in the military as an aviation engineer, then went on to seminary to get a degree in theology, then moved to Ethiopia to teach theology. Now, at the age of 67, is commencing a PhD in church history while he continues to teach. Does that inspire any 60-somethings out there? I've often struggled with the fact that we need to run towards God's global purposes. I've often wondered why people struggle with that, and I think the answer comes in the Bible in the form of what I call the Jonah juxtaposition. Who wouldn't want to have a book in the Bible named after themselves? My guess is that Jonah wouldn't. See, as far as I can tell, he's probably the only one to have four eponymous chapters dedicated solely to himself. And it couldn't be the recounting of noble exploits or the sharing of some time-honored God-revealed truth or even an angelic visitation. No, it had to be a giant, unmitigated foul-up. It might be Jonah's only foul-up, but it's preserved so we can read, raise our eyebrows, cluck our tongues, and judge poor Jonah. Or is he poor Jonah? See, clearly he disobeyed. And in the process, he might provide a moral on a silver plate. Obey God, become a missionary, don't be a dope like Jonah. Powerful stuff if wielded well, but as not as interesting to me as the why behind the what. Why did Jonah, on hearing God's call to Nineveh, head to Tarshish? Sometimes we go for a secondary moral. Jonah was afraid of the Ninevites, so he ran away. Don't be a baby like Jonah. Be brave. Go follow God to where there aren't even any Starbucks. But see, Jonah tips his hand at the end of his short bio and shows us it wasn't fear that made him run. It was his conviction regarding the character of God. Listen to what he says. Isn't this what I said, Lord, when I was still at home? That is what I tried to forestall by fleeing to Tarshish. I knew that you were a gracious and compassionate God, slow to anger and abounding in love, a God who relents from sending calamity. Now, Lord, take away my life, for it is better for me to die than to live. Essentially, if I preach, they might repent. And if they repent, you'll relent. Ergo, no Ninevite carnage. Apparently, Jonah was compelled by his logical conclusion that dead enemies are less likely to visit their nefarious plans on your beloved homeland. He prioritized his perceived sense of national security over God's glory and Ninevite salvation. He didn't want to go because he didn't want them at the party. What about us? What causes us and our people to run away from or towards obedience, towards God's purposes? What makes us run towards God saying, forward, fight for the heart of your king? I've shared my perspectives with you, but I've just invited Ming and Mila to very briefly, in a minute each, to share their perspectives. So Ming, if you would come up, and then Mila.
So before the Global Ship Disciple Program, it never occurred to me how many unreached people group there are in this world that do not know Jesus. And it kind of dawned to me that there are people out there every day dying, and they will never hear what Jesus Christ has done for them. I didn't really have a firm idea of what missions was about, what God's global purpose in my life was. For me, I thought it was about, you know, going to a foreign country and living there for years. And yeah, it may be some case for others, but for myself, I thought, I can't do that. But after the Global Ship Disciple Program, I know now that I don't need to go overseas and live there. I can do short-term missions while using my skills. For example, I'm a nurse, to interact and build relationships with others. After the discipleship program and returning from my Philippines trip, I look back and reflect, and I'm so glad and thankful for the discipleship program. With the preparation, the program provided me everything I needed when I was overseas. What I learned in the discipleship program helped me face challenges overseas while I was out of my comfort zone and in a totally different environment and culture. Not only did the program prepare me while I was overseas, but it has prepared me back at home, in my workplace and in my daily life. It has helped me grow a lot as a Christian and helped me walk a lot closer to God. You know, in the Bible, it specifically says, go out to all nations and tell them about his word. And God has given us, each and every one of us, a global purpose in our lives, whatever it may be. What's yours? Thank you.